You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this is an absolutely cracking episode with a fabulous Venezuelan comic currently resident in Australia, and someone who, if you have downloaded this not knowing his name and decided to take a chance on old Papa Stew's recommendation, then you're in for an absolute treat. You will be rewarded with some of the finest scientific analysis of comedy. This gentleman is someone who taught himself how to do stand-up comedy. There's not really much stand-up in Venezuela, as you're about to hear, and he translated some of the great routines, some classic Louis C.K., Chris Rock routines and so forth, into Spanish, and in doing so, understood from a really internal level the structure, and really just got all Matrix on it. So you're going to love this. There is some, there's some really interesting and very sad stuff about the political state in Venezuela. And it's really fascinating to hear from a comic from a country that I don't know any other comedians from. I think there's at least one other one working in America. Maybe you could inform me about more. But it's such a great episode. We talk about a lot of different things, and something we get stuck into in the second half is the just as soon as Ivan starts talking about Louis C.K.'s foundational premise, you're all going to sit up and listen. So let's, without further ado, let's get stuck in. This is Ivan Aristegueta. I loved your show.
Thank you.
I loved your show. I was predisposed to love your show because we met backstage at the gala.
Yeah.
And where did we meet before? Did we just meet this guy?
We met there.
You're just one of those people that we met and we went, hey, we really get on.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think, oh, I feel like I've met you at 20 festivals.
I have a video of us doing, flipping a bottle.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, okay. It was an immediate bottle flip kind of meeting.
Yeah.
We met backstage at the gala, which you went on to destroy. You had a great gig at the gala. And you have then had a brilliant show here. This is your fifth year, is that right?
Yeah.
Fifth year. And so I couldn't see your show. I tried to come along and see it a few days ago. And so I came to see your extra show, which was sold out to 450 people.
Yeah.
And you destroyed it. And I had not planned to do any more fucking podcasts. And I went, oh, I've got to get you back.
Yes.
So, yeah, there we go. I'm throwing myself down. I'm a big fan.
Great.
I love that show.
Thank you.
Talk to me about who you are. Talk to me, because I know who you are, but tell my listeners who might not have heard of you who you are and what you're up to.
Well, my name is Ivan Aristegueta. I come from Venezuela. I started doing comedy 10 years ago in Venezuela. I did comedy in Spanish for 5 years. Then I migrated to Australia. In Australia, I started doing comedy in English for the first time in English straight away after I migrated. So I got to Australia in January 2012. My first open mic in English was April 2012, right after Adelaide Fringe. I got to see a lot of shows doing Adelaide Fringe. And now I am a full-time comedian in Australia.
And you are the only Venezuelan comedian in Australia?
Yeah.
How many comedians are there in Venezuela?
There's a lot. The thing is, the story of stand-up comedy in Venezuela, It's a very young scene, because Venezuela, we never had that sort of a open mic structure. When I arrived to Australia, it was very impressive to see like a pathway for a career. You get competitions and festivals, stuff like Class Clowns, which I judged this yesterday.
That's very satisfying.
Yeah, it's great. Kids so talented, and they know what stand-up is about, and they're so confident, and they write jokes, and they have great punchlines, and they know how to write a premise. And I got here, wow, there's a platform, there's a pathway if you want to have a career. In Venezuela, 10 years ago when I started, the comedians we had were the comedians from a TV show on the telly, or a few TV shows, and they had their solo shows. No festival, they just rent a theater and they have their shows.
Okay.
And a guy from... So many things happened in Venezuela that made the new, because in brackets, because it's not new. There's it's been around from the 60s, I don't know. You tell me in England when you started this sort of format of...
Sure, okay. Well, I would think in the States it would be Lenny... There's kind of parallel development.
Yeah.
In the States it was Lenny Bruce in the kind of 60s, and then in the UK I guess it was Music Hall from the mid-1800s.
I don't know the dates.
Yes, but you know, it's kind of morphed and developed and stuff.
So in Venezuela what happened with Chavez, with Hugo Chavez, he started closing down TV stations and radio stations because they were opposition. They were very openly and as any, you know, dictator who's got, no, I want my whatever I'm saying to be there, and everything who opposes my ideals, I'm gonna shut them down. So he shut down the longest running TV station in Venezuela, which had the longest running TV show, which was a comedy show.
Okay, what was it called?
Radio Rochela.
Okay.
This it was a sketch show every Monday at 8 o'clock. And without exaggeration, it was on for over 30 years. The same show every Monday at 8 o'clock.
And with the same cast, or like SNL kind of changing, revolving cast members? Or
yes, it was like a nest, a breeding nest of comedians and actors. But there's like a historical, like everybody who went through SNL or Radio Rochela, everybody knows in Venezuela, this is the guys from Radio Rochela.
Okay.
And these are the guys who had their own solo shows. So people didn't know that anyone could have gone on a stage in a bar and do 5 minutes and start trying material and start becoming a comedian. Trying to become a comedian.
So it was just like, if the only comedy, the only live comedy that exists is people who are already famous putting on a big show to their existing audience.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah, yeah. And also, the comedy relief of Venezuelans was this show on television. When these shows, with the whole TV station shuts down, and a lot of radio stations with comedians working on radio, there's like this need of going to and see comedy. And I don't know if it's coincidence or you know, when there's a need, there is an offer. One guy, his name is very English name. His name is George Harris, because I think his parent was American, but he's super Venezuelan. He lived in Spain, and he said, in Spain, there's open mics. Let's do this in Venezuela. So the same format. Monday night, he talked to a very trendy bar in Caracas. Hey, I can bring people on Mondays.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's try it. We lose nothing. We never have people here on Mondays. Okay, and he started the scene of the open mic.
That's so incredible when you can trace the development of comedy in a country to one man that you can name.
Yeah,
one person. Yeah. It's like, how long ago was that?
That was 12 years ago.
Okay. Okay, so you've got, and where are we in relation to Chavez? I know very little about the history of Venezuela.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that moment in your show where you stop and just say, go and find out about Venezuela.
Yeah.
You know, because I know I'm aware of Chavez. I'm aware he's a dictator.
Yeah.
When he's shutting down media and shutting down stations, is he also shutting down live shows?
No. He died.
Okay.
And
I remember there was a eulogy on the Bugle. we'll discuss that later.
The guy who took over was the guy, he said, I'm going to die. This is the guy who you're going to vote for. But everything was
rigged.
Yeah. At the time, it was pretty, very smart. He said, I'm not shutting down a TV station. I'm not renewing the concession to transmit. Because I am the government, so I'm not shutting it down. I'm just giving you...
The license has expired.
There's no money. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. things with live shows, as it was a tiny scene, he didn't care about it. But then one improv group, Venezuelan improv group, who was also the idea was brought by another guy who was from Argentina, who was an improv clown in Argentina, very good, and he started a school in Venezuela. This improv group once they were doing shows for 3-4 years in a theater that was owned by the government. It was a public theater, and this group, something happened. One person from the government died in an accident, and he fell into a river and drowned. You know, this improv shows where the audience write things on papers, mm-hmm. they put stuff in a hat and they take things out and they do according to a certain sort of game, they will follow by the idea from the little paper. So the guy who was pulling out the papers, there was something related to that death. And he was, okay, let's play this. And they played it. And guys from the theater who worked for the government saw that and said, you're banned for life in this theater because you're making fun of someone from the government. From then, when the repression started, you know, tightening up a bit more and a bit more tight, comedy clubs, because the idea was there. So this guy, George Harris, brings the first one and then, oh, this is a great idea. And then, boom, we got five. Mm-hmm. There are no comedy clubs in Venezuela. It's just bars, and the owners of the bars, after 3-4 years of us doing comedy, they started saying, "Listen, guys, can you please don't do any jokes about the government? Because if we have someone from the audience that works for the government, they can fine us or shut us down, and it has happened. So we don't want that. So please be very careful." So we were very, very, you know. We wanted to talk about the government out loud, but we had to do like a little impression, like nothing much.
Okay. Or like an analogy.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you talk about something else for the audience. No, you're talking
exactly,
about
exactly. Not directly. I used to do a joke. It was just an impression of Chavez doing the guy is a bastard. Very charismatic. Like if that guy would have done something else on TV, like a host of anything or announcing soccer, like a football narrator, would have been amazing because his charisma was unbelievable and the attraction of the people was a very charismatic guy. And I said, and I did an impression of Chavez narrating a football game. And then they said, please just don't do that.
Did you say that it was Chavez?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Don't do that anymore. And the guy would have done amazing stuff for television.
Yes, but even that you can't say.
I did it for a long time.
Okay.
But then one day after all the shutting downs and stuff and the whole thing from this improv group, they backed down.
And that must be very difficult from what I know of improv. You need to be able not to edit yourself. Mm-hmm. And then how do you do improv in a situation where hanging over everyone is like, we mustn't say anything about this person, the government, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
That must be very hard. So is there, I want to come back to the Venezuelan scene there and the creativity there, but I want to talk more specifically about your show.
Yeah.
So you grew up as a comedian within that environment. Who were you before you were a comedian?
Comedy was still, you know, we all have it. We all try to do something. In Venezuela, you have this culture of telling jokes. It's so you learn jokes from other people, and there's certain people in society who they take the job of learning as many jokes as they can. And in any social situation, there'll be 3 or 4 guys just debating, not debating, just with the joke battle. Like, I've got this one. Okay, now this one. We're doing drunk people okay. jokes. Okay, now we're doing walking into a bar jokes.
Okay.
This is how we go.
When you say in the society, do you just mean like would happen anywhere, like in Australia?
Yeah.
Or you mean it's like a formalized cultural tradition?
No, no.
Position?
Any, it's not formal. Anyway. Okay. We're in Venezuela in any, you know, gathering. And you start with a joke, boom, there's another one. Start with a joke, there's another one.
Okay.
And there's always like this battle, which is a friendly battle, like who knows more jokes and who can tell a joke better. These are not jokes that you write yourself.
Sure.
These are jokes you learn.
Cultural yeah. currency.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. In fact, there is a journalist, very a well-respected journalist in Venezuela, Nelson Bocaranda. He has... One of his hobbies is a database of jokes.
Okay.
And he's a collector of jokes. And he's famous for that. Like, he can go and he has his iPad. He goes, what do you want? Drunk jokes? And he has on an,
okay.
like on a system. No, he just no, he just
so
collects
surely,
jokes.
There's the internet, and
yeah.
surely now this, he's obsolete.
Yeah, yeah. But it used to be, you know, this little tablet. No, before the tablets, you know, the.
Okay.
He used to have that.
Okay.
Just to type jokes.
So, and
very impressive.
Were you a joke teller?
I was a joke teller. And when this sort of, this first open mic started, one good friend said, hey, let's do stand-up. Let's write our own jokes. You're great at telling jokes. You have, he's a musician, this friend. He's like, there's a lot of melody in the way you tell jokes and you can write your own jokes. Let's do this together. And this friend, I'm very grateful because he takes things very seriously. And we're not going to just stand there and start talking. Let's do some research. And we bought books. We transcribe routines. We
transcribe routines from like American comics?
Yeah, American comics.
Okay, to
yeah.
learn
yeah.
the rhythm. And the,
yeah,
okay.
yeah. And we were obsessed. We were timing laughs per minute. And,
which comics were you transcribing?
We went for the basic. We started with Seinfeld, and then when we were learning about premises, I was like, okay, Chris Rock is really good at premises, and just got obsessed with Chris Rock's how the way he tells one premise, tells a joke, and then he rephrases the same premise
yes.
to tell another joke, and then he rephrases the same premise and tells another joke. He milks one premise, and he can take
yes.
some and then ba-da-da-ba-da-ba-ba-ba, premise, boom, joke, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-boom, boom, joke. Same premise, and I'm sometimes I repeat myself too much in my shows because I want the premise to be very, very clear.
Yes, and well, that Chris Rock says all the premise twice. He said it's set up twice.
Yeah.
That's the thing. No punchline yet. That is the thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of my it's my favorite comedians in the writing in the way he writes. We practice a lot before doing stand-up live for the first time.
Okay.
I used to live in another city. I used to live in Valencia. I used to work in... So who was I before comedy? I was working in a brewery. I am a food technologist, and I started brewing. And I was working in a brewery in another city. Not in my city, not in the capital, not in Caracas. I was in Valencia. And my friend goes, this is happening in Caracas. There's nothing in Valencia. So I used to go weekends. On the weekends to go to Caracas and sat down with my friend and write jokes and talk about comedy.
You were in Valencia in Spain?
In Valencia, Venezuela.
There's
another Valencia.
There's another Valencia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
you actually said in the show your parents are Spanish.
Yeah.
So this
yeah.
is through me. Sorry,
yeah,
go on.
Yeah, yeah. There's a Valencia in Venezuela and there's also a Mérida in Venezuela. Mérida.
Okay.
There's Mérida in Spain and Mérida in Mexico and
okay.
Mérida in Venezuela.
So, okay. And Chavez is dead. I'm up to speed.
Yeah.
I might make
yeah.
more mistakes.
Yeah. So I used to go on weekends and sat down with my friend. It's just... I really can't... Like, I don't waste time on silly hobbies just for the sake of the hobby. It has to have a purpose. And this time, it was just a hobby that I was very happy. Like, I was enjoying myself a lot. And so I traveled with my wife to come to Caracas. She visited her mom. I was writing jokes with a friend, watching shows, watching comedy. I knew I was going to move to Australia eventually. So I always watch a lot of gala shows and a lot of videos from Australian comedy.
So when we were backstage at the gala, that wasn't your first gala?
My second.
It was your second?
Yeah.
So the first time you were backstage at the gala, you are thinking, you're seeing all these acts going, I saw you in 2015, I saw you in 2013, you made this mistake, you have this rhythm. You're approaching it in that technical way still.
The most thing was like, I saw me doing this, and this is the best time, the best day of my life.
Yes!
Like, I saw this from Venezuela. I even told my wife, I'm going to be there one day. I'm going to do the thing.
And your belief in that is based on what? Natural optimism, your confidence in your ability to work hard, and your research of the form. You thought, this is possible. I've watched all these routines.
Yep.
I've learnt it. I've written my own material with my own approach to...
And thanks to the rhythm. to the advice of this friend, he was very, like, the first... I got something. Let me tell you. And he goes, no, you're telling a joke again. This is not stand-up. Where's the premise? I go, and do it again. And where's the premise? And then when the premise was clear, because premise, the concept is easy, but it's not easy to write a good premise.
I absolutely agree with you. Can you give me an example of that from your writing process? Something in the, I don't know, I mean, I could suggest a bit like the mango bit, your mango material. It's opening material. It's a good concept because it's about mangoes and the fact of you being a Venezuelan guy now in Australia, and you, the craftsmanship of that whole section is excellent. So can you talk to us about some of the decisions made in the difference between a concept and the premise with reference to that piece of material?
So the... Should I tell the joke first?
Yeah, by all means. Oh, of course.
So the premise went back to the basics, which is a simple premise that we all say on everyday life. When you win something, you lose something. So to put more ornament into that premise as an immigrant, is that when you're an immigrant, the number one lesson you're going to learn is when you win something, you lose something. And then I say, Venezuela, there's a lot of crime, a lot of violence, shameless corruption. But mangoes, they are for free. Then Australia is a beautiful first world country, safety, freedom. But mangoes, $5 a mango. So that's just the basic.
Yes.
And I wanted to say, when you win something, you lose something. And it was this is the whole premise of the whole show. It's about balance.
Yes.
Nothing is 100% good or 100% bad. So I was talking to Chris, my manager, who is now he directed the show. But he gave me direction, because I think stand-up shows, they're not directed as a theater show. You need just like a writing partner who understands you as a persona, who understands your point of view, who understands your jokes, and gives you... You need someone to go, you're talking too much here, you're talking too much there. This is a great joke, but doesn't work for the show.
Yes.
And Chris...
That's a great example of a note.
Yeah.
That's a great joke, it doesn't work in this show. If someone says that, you're like, this is a good director for stand-up.
Yeah.
So this is Ivan. I, as you may be able to tell from the timbre of my voice, I'm absolutely exhausted. I'm jet lagged. I'm recording this at 7:45 on the Monday of its release, or its very soon release, and I have been awake for so long, returning from the Montreal Comedy Festival, where I'm pleased to tell you I managed to get 5 excellent episodes in the can with K. Trevor Wilson, Sugar Sammy, the live episode with W. Kamau Bell, Sashir Zamata, who plays, if you're familiar with SNL, she was in SNL for a little while, she plays Keeley in Black Jeopardy. I've certainly been enjoying those online, and a very fine stand-up as well. And Lisa Traeger, who is absolutely fantastic, and anyone interested in feminism and in the voices of new, young, exciting female comics who are just blowing up in America are really going to enjoy Lisa and indeed Sashir's interviews. Loads and loads to enjoy there. Some really great work. I had a fantastic time in Montreal. I will have to tell you about it in more detail another time, but thank you to everyone who looked after me there, and thanks to everyone I managed to hang out with, even if only briefly. It was a lot of fun hanging out with Ivan, and also Damien Damien Power, who I highly recommend you check out Damien's show at Edinburgh. I'm still working on Ivan to get him over to Edinburgh in 2018, but I know that Damien Power is going to be at the Edinburgh Festival. I can't wait to see his show, which won some sort of award or other in Australia. I can't remember the details, but I think you're really going to enjoy that. I've heard loads about it, and I've only seen him do a short set. Can't wait to get stuck into that. I will try and do some Edinburgh recommendations for those of you who are going to be up there. I'll do those via the Comedians Comedian Facebook group, so join up to that if you haven't already. There's nearly, we're getting over 5,000 members at the moment. I'm having to start policing some of the chats. There's so many people. But I'll get the recommendations on there. Obviously, you're going to go and see Matt Ewins and all the people who I usually recommend and all the people who have done previous episodes of this pod. Ivan isn't there this year, but I hope he will be soon. Nick Cody from... Who have we got from recent episodes is going to be up there? Barry Cryer will be there. Simon Munnery will be there. Just looking at these, I think Orlando Baxter's coming back. Who else? Pippa Evans. I mean, so, you know, look down the list. And I always forget who did this, but if you do check on the... I've got a good idea of the guy that put this together, but I never want to say his name in case I get it wrong. So have a look at ComComPod, or indeed on the ComCom Facebook group. If you scroll down, you will see an extremely helpful list with lots of ticket links that a very kind listener has made for all previous ComCom guests currently appearing at the Edinburgh Festival. So I'll get on to them. I'll get on to some recommendations. I'm falling apart. I'm so tired. I'll get on to some recommendations as soon as I can. Do donate to the show if you fancy supporting it. I was told off on Twitter recently by someone who said, "Hey man, not cool," or words to that effect. It's a bit needy to be asking for donations in the middle of the show. No, you're absolutely right. I should ask for donations at the very end of the show when everyone's turned off. If you would like to support the show and don't want to complain about it, then... And let's face it, if you don't want to support the show, that's fine. I think I spend less time talking about donations on this podcast than I would do advertising any of the numerous people you're sick of hearing from all your other podcast hosts. So I'm not going to feel too bad about it. If you would like to support the show, then you can go to comedianscomedian.com/donate and set up a recurring subscription payment via PayPal, or if you don't use PayPal, Moonclerk, or Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/comcompod, you can find all the different ways to donate, or do a little one-off PayPal donation as well. If you are someone who has been waiting patiently for your t-shirt, or even emailing me and saying, "Where's my goddamn t-shirt?" They are all in the post, apart from two, and I will email those two people separately to explain the cock-up that was made by the... I don't think it was me, but there was a small cock-up. So there's two people who will have to wait a little bit longer. Are you one of them, or will you be receiving it in the next week? Who can say? Who can dare to dream? But we had a really fun, jet-lagged, multiple hour, me and Mrs. Goldsmith sat and ploughed whilst the Boutros slept. We sat and ploughed through a lot of t-shirt admin, and those are now all safely in the arms of Mama Post Office. So they should be coming to you very soon. That's going to do me for now. Do come along to my show at Edinburgh, 3:45 at the Liquid Rooms Annex. That begins this Saturday, the 5th of August. We're travelling up tomorrow. I'm going to go and pack. No, I'm not. I'm going to stay here and record the final blurbs for this bit after we speak to Ivan, and then I'm going to fall asleep in a heap. Let's get back to Ivan Aristeguieta.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So this guy, just to, is this the same guy that you were writing with?
No, this is my manager in Australia.
Okay, sorry, yeah.
Chris MacDonald.
Okay.
My friend in Venezuela is Cesar. Cesar. Working with him helped me a lot. Like, because you need that critic going, no, this joke is not that good. It's a good joke, but it's not that good. Burn the baby. He says that. You have to burn the baby. And you go, no, I love this joke. You have to burn the baby.
Yes.
And then he goes, you do whatever you want to do. I'm just telling you that you should burn that baby because it's resting energy and importance to other good punchlines. So you have like, okay, boom, good punchline. And then a silly joke, it drags down some energy from the audience that you don't. And it's hard. And he has this phrase that a precision wordsmith, which I like that. And Caesar was in Venezuela that guy. He was also writing for himself. But he's more like a musical comedian. He's also very another comedy nerd, and we talk about this. So, like, we enjoy just sitting down and analyzing premises and analyzing comedians. And then I was very happy that he in Australia, I found Chris, who has a lot of experience writing comedy, writing sitcoms. He's been in the comedy world for a while, and it's good to have a friend telling you, this joke is shit, or this joke is not working. You might love the joke, you want to talk about this subject, but it's not working. And you go, no! You have to take it out.
Yes.
So from the first show, if you watched this show the first night in Adelaide Fringe, that was 8 weeks ago, it was a different show. Same jokes, but different.
Because the mango, the bit that I remember, the bit that I've told two people about today, like, oh God, you've got to go see Ivan. The bit that I remember the most, I remember that setup, absolutely. That's the concept is mangoes are really expensive here. The premise is when you take something, you give something away, and you know, the premise is the difference between Venezuela and Australia seen through the prism of mangoes are free, mangoes are expensive.
Yeah.
But then the detail of the joke, the bit that I remember is when you were going, you're talking about how you eat mangoes here weird.
Yeah.
It's another good observation. Everyone knows that thing of cutting a mango.
Yeah.
Pixelated porcupine.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, I think that was the first bit when I really sat up and went, oh, okay. I'm not just watching my friend anymore. Here we go. Pixelated porcupine. And then the moment that I've been telling a couple of people today is... when I eat a mango, I don't take phone calls.
Yeah.
And that is a beautiful... it's not an observation, it's not a premise, but it's a completely character-driven approach to a subject that we're already talking about.
Yeah.
So that's... How long is the mango section? Is it like 4 minutes?
It could be, four minutes.
About 4 minutes.
Yeah.
I correctly guessed the mango duration.
Yeah.
And the punchlines are, as you say, there is no dead weight. There is... concept, premise, joke, exploration of joke, character-driven joke.
Yeah.
There's a moment later in the show where you're talking about Australians complaining. You take the idea that people complain differently here because the bar of what is bad is so high compared to your own home life.
Yeah.
The post office bit.
Yeah.
So you're doing you take that idea and you inhabit a guy, an Australian guy, talking to his son... who's just invented the idea for post offices.
Yeah.
And the son is going, why don't we have a thing? And it's a very funny, characterful impersonation. Yeah. Why don't we have a place that sells? You can do letters. You can charge up your Mikey card. You can do all these things. You can sell tiny little deck chairs. Really, the observation is, wow, post office sell a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's perfectly nested within
the
characterful child explaining it so that you can then come back to the idea of the dad saying, it's not good enough.
Yeah.
You know, and I honestly, I stopped writing notes.
Great.
So good, and I'm fascinated to hear. In many ways, it's a relief to hear, because if you just sat here and said, hey, I'm just a talented comedian, I just know how it works, that's fine. But I am fascinated to know that you have taken existing routines and in a very thorough, methodical way, you've gone, this is what's important. This is what's important.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic.
The clarifying the premise is... It's the hard bit.
That's
where I work.
Okay. So can you give us an example of a premise that you were not able to clarify from this show that you had to drop? Or something from your recent writing?
This is a long joke, and it's good for a festival show because it's in the middle and it takes a long time to set up. But I love this joke. I love the dumplings.
Yes.
So I take time to explain how frustrating it is to break up when you still love each other because the relationship is simply not working. And I talk about... So this is a long setup, and it's a very heartfelt setup.
Yes.
And then I go, I'm going to explain this with dumplings.
It's so lovely to watch. That is such a characterful way of doing it. Rather than just talking about dumplings and we realize it's relationships, the fact of the sort of, not quite the naivety, but the simplicity of you saying, I will now explain this with dumplings. And yeah. It's an echo of, I'm going to explain this with dogs.
Yeah.
That is so character driven.
Yeah.
Because you are this, you know, impish, very charming, very Venezuelan guy, Spanish
yeah.
guy.
Yeah.
But you also, you manage to employ language in such a way that you enjoy the simplicity of
yeah.
the position. So tell me about that.
Because I think that's what comedy is about. Comedy is about, so the work is to put everybody on your point of view with the less amount of words if possible. Like, you got to laugh with me. Like, you think things are funny. Everybody thinks anything could be funny. Anything can be funny, depending on the eyes who are looking at something funny. So that's why the premise is so important, or the setup. So you're like, okay, all right, come to my world. Okay, now you're in my world. Now look at this. So when I explain my situation in the breakup, that is a big premise. It's a big setup. I go, you don't understand each other. Frustration starts building up. And then when you're full of frustration, you start hurting each other. I'm going to explain this with dumplings. You know, when you eat the slippery dumpling, then the slippery, and then I love dumplings. I love chops. I love eating dumplings with chopsticks. And then you go, hey, fucking dumpling. You're just too slippery. You fuck your dumpling. And then, hey, dumpling. And then you end up, the frustration builds up and you end up stabbing the dumpling. You fucking dumpling. Got you. That's a super elaborated joke. It's not a simple premise.
No. What was the starting point for that? It feels to me now like the starting point is the observation that eating dumplings is frustrating and
yeah.
everyone ends up stabbing the dumpling.
Yeah.
So was that the starting point?
Yeah.
Was that the note that you made?
Yeah.
And then in the writing you go, oh, that's kind of like a relationship.
Yeah.
I mean, with a, you know.
Yeah, because you love the dumpling. You don't want it to do it badly.
But this is it.
And then you end up hating the dumpling and stabbing it and you don't enjoy the eating. Because it becomes, instead of eating the dumpling, it becomes grabbing the fucking dumpling.
Yes.
It takes from the joyful nourishment to the action.
It's so, I mean, it's really Seinfeld in that the premise is so clean. There's no fat on that. It's like you start with a thing. You're writing towards it knowing that when we get there, the example you're using is completely universal, because the example you're, it's like as a comedian you're pretending to use an example like this, but really as a writer
yeah.
you start with the example
yeah.
and end up it
yeah and that's our job, just to remember stuff that we consider there's something here
yes.
but then it will come up one day when you want to explain something.
So
like the dogs. Like the dogs, it's the same thing.
I know what you mean, but if you don't mind, explain
yeah,
a bit.
Because I said that it takes a long time that you want to immigrate, and then you once you live in a better place, you realize that nothing is 100% good or bad. It's always a balance. So I go, the dogs, I'm going to explain this with dogs. So dogs in first world countries, dogs in Australia, they live at home with families. They have a lot of affection. They go to a special park for dogs, which is for people from a third world country. I go, there's a special
yes,
park
I've
for dogs.
I've never seen a special park for dogs, but the reaction, I was like, oh, clearly there's a special park for dogs here.
Yeah. Yeah, there are dog parks in Australia and dog beaches.
Yes.
Which is amazing. I love that. I enjoy this. But then I realized I was talking to a friend, and if you don't have your dog neutered, you have to pay taxes.
Okay.
Because that means that you can use your dog for breeding.
Yeah.
And this is a new world for me. Like, that's weird for someone coming from Venezuela.
Me too, but yeah.
And I go, so it's cheaper to neuter your dog than to keep it with its balls. wow. And then I started thinking about dogs. You don't see street dogs in Australia. If you've traveled into a third world country, it's a common thing just to see dogs in the city, in the highway. In if you're eating, there will be a dog just wanting food just next to you in any third world country. And I said, but these dogs, they don't get their balls cut off. And that is the price. That is the tax. If you want a good life, you just give your balls away.
And the beginning of that routine was, wow, they have play parts for dogs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lesser comedian would come on and say, hey, those play parts for dogs are a bit weird.
Exactly.
And everyone's like, well, we get that. And yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. But it's not, there's nothing concealed. That isn't a revelation.
Yeah.
That's so good. This is one of those episodes I don't want to release anymore. I just want to employ this technique and not fucking tell anyone.
I like saying infinite fractal canine gangbang.
Yeah, I know. I could see you enjoying it.
People go, ha ha ha. It's not like a big laugh, but I go, I want to say this. I want to say infinite fractal canine gangbang.
Should you not burn that baby?
It could be burned.
But at the same time,
I get a bigger laugh with puppy poopy parcel packaging.
Yeah.
Because it's
not so clever. It's not so well written.
But it's
a bigger laugh.
But it's building up with the whole alliteration thing that I state from the beginning with the pixelated porcupine.
Yes. Yes. By pointing out that word is alliteration, you are revealing that you know the word alliteration. That's the important quality of that. By the way, I'm smarter than you realize, which is quite nice. It gives us a lot of trust in you. Now, something I really recognized in your work is that you are very good at writing for the universal. Everyone in that room got all of your material. All of those things. There was a guy behind me, clearly a Venezuelan guy, when you were talking about the churros and the olive oil. He was salivating. He was out loud. He was going, oh, yeah. And his girlfriend was like, shut up. Like this, because, so there are obvious things there. There are kind of cultural references that some people are particularly excited about. But the jokes, the punchlines are, I thought of Ursula Carlson, who has a similar kind of, I guess, in terms of profile, she's bigger than you here.
Yeah.
But you have a similar quality whereby someone watching that goes, whoa, this guy could work anyway.
Thank you for saying that, because I still don't think I'm ready for Edinburgh or England or... Because my material is very Aussie.
Yes, it is, but it would not take long to tweak certain parts of it. She'll be right. That whole routine would work. The fuck spiders bit wouldn't work.
Yeah.
But she'll be right. We understand that. We know that there's enough people that know that. So you could sit down with an English comic and go, okay, this, and there would not be a problem at all.
Okay.
You write universally. You write, and this is a thing I was talking to Orlando Baxter about this yesterday, and talking about that quality of knowing what's going on in the room and what is important to the people who come to see you. Some comedians, I think maybe I fall into this trap. I'm excited to talk about me and what I think, but you have a real, you can talk about what they recognize. Okay. And that is a quality I would like to get more of. So do you ever spend time thinking about who you are or who they see when they see you, the persona?
Yeah.
Or is most of your writing time, your creative time, concerned with trying to work out who they are? That is a very open and complicated question.
Last night I had a conversation with a guy who is a sociologist, and he saw the show. And he's like, man, I've been a sociologist?
Yes.
For many, many years, and he was like, fuck you, man, you're a fucking sociologist. You're describing Australia, all the mannerisms, all the way that you're dissecting the whole thing. When I came to Australia, and I wanted to keep doing comedy because I ended up being a full-time comedian in Venezuela. I was in radio, and I was like, this is it. I've done so many things, but this is the thing that I don't mind. You know, it's like falling in love. I mean... When you fall in love with the good things and the bad things. That's the real falling in love. When you acknowledge the bad things and you go, I can take this.
Mm-hmm.
The good bit, I know. It's easy to fall in love with the good part. But when you know the bad part and you still like it, you're fully in love. And I've had so many different types of jobs that I pursued. Like, I wanted to be a brewer. I love making food, and I love taste, and I love biochemistry, and I love yeast, and I love all the pathways of I love that stuff, and I love food as a culture and as a passing on culture and the connection with people. So I studied food technology, and then I worked in a brewery. But then working in a restaurant and working in a brewery, I hated the bad things. I was in love with the good things,
okay,
but I completely hated the bad things. Sorry. And with comedy, I know the bad things, and I like them. I like the touring. I like. It's not that I enjoy them, but I'm okay with it. I'm okay with the loneliness. I'm okay with the peaks and troughs of emotional. Like, one day you think you're the king of the world, and then the other day you just want to hide under a bed and eat Doritos and never come out. And you don't sleep much because you train your brain to be in constant thinking, constant motion, and you don't sleep well. And you don't have time to properly connect with friends and family because you keep traveling. And I'm okay. Like, of course I need breaks, but I prefer that bad thing than the other jobs. The bad things of the other jobs. Like, I'm okay with it.
Yes.
So when I found that, I went, I want this. So I came to Australia. I really want to do comedy here. What do I need to do? I need to learn about Australians. I need to have a lot of Aussie friends. I need to ask a lot of questions. I need to, because comedy, people ask me a lot, is there a different sense of humor? I go, no. I don't believe in that, because otherwise Seinfeld and Friends and all the cheese, all these shows, they have been dubbed many, many languages, and they've been shown in different worlds, and they've been successful in different countries. So comedy, sense of humor is universal. It's not a specific sense of humor. What I got, sense of humor is could be referential. You need to know about the references. You need to know how to... There's a bit of empathy. It's like a relationship. You go... when you show you care... To adapt to a new country, it's the same thing as a first date with a woman or a job interview. You have to show interest. You have to ask questions. And say, hey, I'm interested in this. I'm interested in you. So I realized that in Australia, when people go, when I stop a conversation because I don't get a word, I go, sorry, and they repeat the word. Sorry, I don't get it. How do you spell it? And then they spell it for me. And then I see the word, I see the letters. Now I can connect a word with the sound, and I say the sound. Instead of being an interruption, they are all very grateful that I did that because I want to communicate better. So I think it was like a natural... progression of me understanding Aussies and realizing that, oh, you like when I get you. Let me keep learning about you, and I want to know the differences. And then I knew that the Australians, they love knowing about Venezuela because they have no fucking idea.
Absolutely.
And let me compare Australians with Venezuelans. So I think it was a natural progression. I didn't do it on purpose. The thing on purpose was, let me adapt to Australia as soon as possible so I can do comedy here. And then everything developed. I have a question for you, because I want to know your opinion. I saw an article. You probably wrote it. I don't know.
I don't know.
Like 2 or 3 years ago. It was about, like, this guy was saying that every comedian has like a foundational premise. And when I read this article, I talked to my friend Cesar, who's also a musician and comedian. He was like, yes, even musicians, they all have like a base point of view.
The basic reason for being there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he analyzes, this article was, there was an analysis of Louis C.K. And he goes, the basic foundational premise of Louis C.K. It's not a premise, just an attitude. He is ashamed. Ashamed of being white, ashamed of being a man, ashamed of being fat, ashamed of being old, ashamed of his way of parenting, ashamed of his way of behaving.
Yes.
Every show he's done, if you see it with that perspective, you go, yeah, he is ashamed.
He is confessing to how awful he is.
Yeah, and everything he does is about that. Even his TV show, Louis. And I want to know that about my comedy. And I keep asking these questions. And I don't have the answer yet.
Yes,
but I want.
I
think every comedian will have that basic thing.
Yes. And I think actually when a lot of the time when we say finding your voice in comedy,
yeah.
I think maybe that is people connecting with their foundational premise.
Yeah.
When you know that, it's difficult. I wouldn't have said shame with Louis C.K., but you're absolutely right.
The guy who wrote the article.
Yes, no, that was me. I think that's absolutely right. And I think that is... It's very difficult to find because I have seen, and we have all seen, people contrive a foundational premise that is inaccurate for themselves.
Yeah.
And you watch them and you're like, don't do this. This isn't you.
Yeah.
But you can't... Can you help someone find one?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I've got friends telling me, well, you do cultural differences. I do that.
Yeah,
but that's not the thing.
That's the vehicle. That's not the driver.
Yeah, exactly. And they go, no, you're grateful. Yeah, but it's not that. Now, just talking here, I came up with the idea of adaptation because I am an immigrant and or empathy, putting yourself in people's shoes. I don't know.
Yes, it's not either of those two things.
No,
those
no.
Aren't a foundational
and it's
premise.
It's hard. It's hard because
yes.
maybe it's not a premise. Maybe it's like because shame is a feeling.
Yes. Yes, I mean, I would think is kind of celebration.
Okay.
Maybe, but that is going to be difficult because shame, that is a big, powerful,
big
gut, secret, kind of awful thing. Whereas celebration, well, right, okay,
yeah,
fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is it. Maybe that's Ivan 2.0.
That is our quest.
That's
for
the quest.
For every comedian. Just find what's the thing. What's the that big bang? What's the little thing that started everything from the way we think? We have a point of view. You know Damien Power?
I have only seen him do 5 minutes. I know him, lovely guy. Saw him at the gala. I haven't been able to see his show.
He's one of my favorite comedians in Australia because he's a very complicated man, and he translates his complicated brain with simple words to a simple audience.
He got nominated for the Barry this year for his show Utopia, which I believe he is taking to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
So
and
listen to this if you're going to be at the festival.
And
I haven't seen it, but I've heard a lot of good stuff.
I strongly recommend. He uses simple words to describe his very complicated theories. Like he's a master with writing premises, translating, putting people in to see the world through his eyes. What are we going to say about Damien? So I say, for me, Damien is ashamed of being a human. Everything I've
he's
seen.
He's ashamed on the behalf of.
He's
all of
ashamed of humankind. Everything he does is about that. Every joke that I got, and I told him that, and he laughed. He was like, "Yeah, maybe, maybe."
Yes.
And that's a great. To every, his point of view of every joke, he's like, "We're doing something wrong. As humans, we took the wrong path."
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very interesting perspective through which to examine all comedy.
Yeah.
That's like an elite. That's like if you spend 10 years transcribing routines, you're like, oh, actually, this is what I should be. I'm trying to transcribe foundational premises.
Yeah.
Oh, why don't we have more time to talk about this? We could talk about this a lot. Now this is too helpful for me not to release. I was considering saving the episode. Sorry, Ivan, it was corrupted. There's no idea. I just kept it for myself. But this is a really interesting way of looking at it. Let's move on because we have limited time. A question I'm fond of asking people is to ask you which elements of your comedy are you very comfortable with? Which do you regard as your comedy superpowers?
Food,
that's not a comedy. That's not a common kind of an answer. But let's talk about why you mean that. Because I kind of see what you mean. Yeah.
Because I connect. I see food is it's a great vehicle to connect with people. And given examples of any theory that you have with food, everybody relates to food.
Yes, I agree.
That so the joke's not about the food. The joke is just, the food is just a vehicle to explain. And I use that a lot.
Maybe your foundational premise is sensuality. You are a very sensual comedian. You talk about food and the, yeah. You know, I take my time with the mango. And, you know, there is a real, the show is called Joofy.
Yeah.
And you've used chorizo in the past as a show title. So, you know, There is definitely that. That's, but again, that's the means by which you are communicating.
Yeah.
So that's interesting that you would have that reaction. But I mean, in terms of your bag of tricks, like the things that you are particularly good at doing on stage,
okay,
rather than subject matter. Like for me, I give you an example. You began the show. I don't know if you do this every time. Big brassy music playing. Yeah. Your hands visible at the side of the stage.
Yeah.
Getting everyone clapping along. I was like, Wow, this is a carnival-esque party atmosphere. Yeah. I'm going to lazily make the assumption that, hey, he's bringing a little bit of Venezuela. You know what I mean? In a way that, like, I've never been there. It sounds pretty, you know.
Yeah.
So you walk on to, you know, a real zesty sort of a thing like that.
I want them to have a good time.
Yes.
But I don't know. I'm loud. I realize that when I speak out loud, I pronounce better.
Maybe as well, one of the things you do, thinking about in the light of what you said now, is that you are very good at concealing the work. I think you are good at concealing the work that you've done.
Okay.
I didn't come into this interview thinking, I imagine Ivan is a very methodical guy who has transcribed lots of routines.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, he's a very natural, sensual connection with the audience guy. All of that is true, but you make sure your process may be methodical, but your performance is not workmanlike.
There's a lot of senses. You know, I read this article about you know, when you watch a movie, apparently the if you see a lot of running, your brain, the running part of your brain is activated, although you're sitting down, is activated. And if someone is eating, that part is activated.
Okay.
And if you're, so when you tell a story, the more senses you use, the more attention you get from the audience, because you activate more part of their brains.
Yes.
So when you talk about food and describes the texture of something and describe how something looks like, the people will be very attentive.
Of course.
They will pay a lot of attention because the brain have to activate a lot of areas. So when I do the loud thing, make them clap. I know, I love Stuart Lee. His, but I know he hates that shit. And I go, he makes fun of stuff that I do. I go, okay.
Of course.
It's like Michael McIntyre just running on stage, and he makes fun of that. And I go, yeah, I do the running on stage because it works.
It's a big room, and it works, and it's motion based, and it holds people's attention. Absolutely.
And it's part of my personality. Like I hug people a lot. So I need to, I cannot hug the audience. So I need to do something that's why also I go back to the food. When I talk about the olive oil, I do that on purpose.
Yeah.
Because I can feel the audience is absolutely paying attention to everything I'm saying. Because I'm describing food. There's no jokes there. I just do it for the sake of just be here with me and salivate with me.
That's a fantastic answer, Ivan. What weapons, what superpowers do you feel that you lack as a comedian?
Ah, good. I'm not good with one-liners. I try to. I think the perfect premise is when there is a premise and a one-liner at the same time.
Have you written any one-liner? I think I've written 3 one-liners in my career. I'm fiercely proud of them, and I'm very painfully aware I've only written 3.
I don't know if I... Because I continue to joke, so I don't leave it there. I go, I think one old joke, like, it's not a one-liner, it's just a premise. I'm afraid Australia I'm freaking out here because I am afraid. I'm not afraid of the common things like snakes or spiders. Why do you have so many TV ads for funeral insurance? It's just an observation. I think I don't have one-liners. I don't have to go back and analyze. But I'm not. I like when the premise is, when it's a premise with a punchline. That's like the perfect. And then you just do an act out with another punchline. That's a perfect joke.
And what does it look like when you are sitting writing? Are you writing in a laptop? Are you writing in a notebook? Are you just writing on stage and then remembering it?
The three things. So notebook is just for ideas. The writing process is on a laptop. And I highlight punchlines. I highlight act outs. I put premises on italics.
explain this to me again. You write the stuff out and you have different coded italics and headline
premises on italics,
yes,
and punchlines and act outs on bold.
And you write the whole routine out, every word, longhand
at the beginning. Yeah, it changes after a few shows, but the I want to know I have the clear premise, and I know the premise is here because it's on italics. And then the punchline is here, so I have three lines before the punchline. Okay. Or let's see if I can do two lines before the punchline. Or let's see if I can jump into an act out straight away, because it's funny. When I go and I do the Spanish grandma, he's from Australia. He lives in Australia now. I think they broke him. I know that whole set, it's on bold, because it's a funny accent with a few jokes in it. So I want to have clear that I have a premise. There's one great... Netflix is giving us so much stuff to watch.
Yeah.
And I can name many, many. But not because she's from a Latino background, but Cristela Alonso.
Okay, don't know.
She goes, premise, boom, joke. Rests, enjoys the moment. Premise, good joke. Rests, enjoys the moment. Perfect.
Is there a danger that your formula for writing is scientifically strong but formulaic?
No. Because when you start doing the show, that's when you add the... Because I've come from a cooking background, and when you learn how to cook, they don't go, let's create something together. No, they go, this is how you cut, this is how you chop, these are different cuts. And the French are the ones who put the cooking training, like the formalized in the Western world. They go, first you need to know how to use a knife. Then you cut. There's a Brunoise, there's a Allumette, there's a Julienne, and then now you have to make broths and the basis for the sauces. How to make a demi-glace, and then you, okay, this is how you fry, how you braise, how you roast. And then when you have that, do your thing. I believe in that. I know comedians who don't believe in that, and I respect them because they're great comedians. And there's so many ways to go to Rome, but I believe in learning first. In martial arts, we were talking about martial arts before recording this, they call it the Kihon, which is basic technique. When you do martial arts and then you have this big master coming from another country to teach you a big seminar, and you think, oh, I'm going to start jumping and use weapons and stuff. And they go, no, let's go to the basic punch. Let's see how you put your fist, how you position your fist. And is this not just, we're going to focus on your fist and then your stance for the whole day? And then you, come on, teach me how to use
nunchucks. Flying kick with nunchucks.
I don't want to do it with nunchucks. And then, no, it's the basic stance. And I see that. It's this, the formula. It's not a formula. It's just a basic stance. And if the premise is not clear, the joke doesn't work. Why? Because people doesn't understand your point of view. That's it. So I I don't think I'm doing a formula. I think I'm doing just basic stance. And you know when tailors they make, when they're making a suit, they make like big stitches just to follow where they're gonna, and then you can see the stitches. But then when they finish the suit, they cut, they think that they take it out.
They pull the thread.
They pull the thread and you see nothing. So when you start doing comedy at the beginning, you see the stitches. But then when you become a better comedian, you pull the thread out and you don't, you, is there, there's an illusion that there's no structure, but there's a lot of structure. If you see Robin Williams stuff and you transcribe that, you think, oh, this guy was just crazy, just throwing stuff from his brain. And then you, if you analyze that, there it is. The formula is right there. It's there. I promise.
Thank you, Imran. I am so gutted that we don't have more time for this. We could talk for hours. This is exactly what I wanted. I'm so thrilled to have this conversation. Man. I feel we have to wrap this up with two quick things. Are you happy?
Happy for me means acceptance. And I'm happy with my life. Because this joke was about learning that. This show was about learning acceptance, learning that there's always a balance, and being cool with the balance, because it's impossible to have everything 100% great. So yes, I'm happy.
Last thing, what would you have engraved on your comedy gravestone?
Wow. I don't know. I haven't thought about that. Probably like, he died here, but he never died on stage.
Thanks,
man. You're welcome, thank man. Thank you so much. Had a great time.
So that was Ivan. Check out his website. I'm sure that Google, if you can't remember how to spell his name perfectly, Google will point you in the right direction. He's very on it. He's one of those keynote speaker guys. He's got a load of stuff on there. I should say the photos aren't completely... I think this... I don't know. Did we talk about his Panama hat? He's got this sort of hat image that I think he's going to grow out of. In fact, he probably already has. How patronising is this? Listen, I know him quite well. We hung out a lot in Australia and Montreal, so I feel comfortable patronising him by, you know, by assuming he's grown out of the hat thing. Check out his website, and if you're in Australia, do get to see him. And if you're in, if you're going to be in Edinburgh next year, then simply wait with bated breath while I continue harassing him and trying to convince him to come over. Just a sensational comic, just note perfect, faultless, clean as a whistle, Seinfeld-esque, bang bang bang, that's the idea, that's the premise, here's it unpacked, here's it explored, let's move on to the next one. Beautiful, absolute treat to watch him. So that's all from Ivan. Do donate at comedianscomedian.com/donate. You can support the show however you'd like with a 5-star review on iTunes, particularly if you live outside of the UK, telling your friends about it and tweeting me at ComComPod or email me info@comedianscomedian.com. I will get back to everyone that emails me. If you're Ren, if you're out there, you've still not been in touch, I'm unable to thank you for your sizable donation to the show. I really appreciate it, but the email associated with your PayPal is bouncing, so please accept this as a grovelling thank you for that very kind donation. If you'd like to purchase further t-shirts, I will work out how to do it down the line. No, there's no post-amble today. I am absolutely destroyed with tiredness and jet lag and all the rest of it. So I'm going to sign off now. I'll see you up at Edinburgh. Remember, everyone's a comedian. You can go to the notes of this episode. It's the free crowdsourced comedy experiment. It's 7:30 on the 14th of August at Subway on Cowgate in Edinburgh. If you're going to be there, please do come along. It's free and unticketed. So just turn up and see me flounder my way through an entirely crowdsourced hour of your suggestions for jokes, material, stories, and so forth. And I'll see you at 3:45 at the Liquid Rooms Annex for the old solo show. All right, gang, thanks for listening.
Oh, so tired.